So the title of the talk is Is Evolution Bad? So,
the idea of giving a talk on that arose from the fact that recently, I guess mainly as a result of the creationist evolutionist controversy, a number of prominent scientists have made the point that evolution is a fact, but then they go on to qualify this by saying that we don't really know so much about the mechanism of evolution. That is, there are still questions that remain to be settled as to exactly what the mechanism of evolution is. But nonetheless, we can understand that evolution per se is a fact. So I wanted to discuss this. The first point to make is that the statement is that we don't know the mechanism. This assumes that there is a mechanism. That is, that evolution can be described in mechanistic terms. The origin of life can be described in mechanistic terms. So, apparently that is what is being regarded as a fact. There are, for example, various alternative theories of the origin of life, some of which definitely can be called evolutionary. But I could name a couple. For example, there's Whitehead's process philosophy, in which you have a sentient being, God, who's manipulating the actions of different organisms in such a way as to get them to assume certain forms. So that's an example of actually a non-mechanistic theory of evolution. And there are quite a number of other examples of this. But when scientists say that evolution is a fact, they definitely do not have in mind any theories of this kind. The basic paradigm of modern science is to explain everything in mechanistic terms. This means in terms of measurements, equations, mathematical formulae, and so forth. So, and more specifically, the idea is that the underlying mechanism behind any natural phenomenon would be the laws of physics. So evolutionary theory must also boil down to the action of the laws of physics. And in fact, that is precisely what Darwin's contribution was in terms of providing an explanation of evolution. His idea was that by the processes of random variation and natural selection, you could explain the origin of all different life forms entirely in mechanistic terms. It would reduce down to the laws of physics. So that's essentially what I want to discuss. So I'll just start the discussion by saying a couple things briefly about what is involved in a mechanistic theory of the origin of life. Essentially, in modern science, this kind of theory is broken down into two parts. One is called molecular evolution, and the other is what you can call phylogenic evolution. So, this first slide illustrates one recent theory concerning molecular evolution. The idea of molecular evolution is that you start with generally a primordial earth in which there is no life, in which chemicals are arranged in a disorganized fashion within some kind of primordial ocean. And then by some kind of chemical processes based entirely on physical laws, the first cell arises. So many people have given a great deal of thought to how this could happen. This particular outline of steps is a model which was devised by Manfred Eigen and elaborated at some length recently. And he has a series of stages of chemical reactions of increasing complexity, which he proposes will culminate in the production of the first self-reproducing cell. So that's the idea of chemical evolution. It's significant that the basic principles that Eigen invokes are those of natural selection and some kind of random change. His idea is that at first, self-replicating molecules will arise within the primordial ocean. He chooses RNA molecules for this. And that gradually, some of these molecules will happen to somehow generate certain protein sequences, which will in turn catalyze the reproduction of those molecules. So his basic application of the principle of natural selection is that if a protein arises from a molecule which catalyzes the reproduction of that molecule to a greater degree than the reproduction of other molecules that may be in the solution, then the population of that kind of molecule will increase at the expense of all the others and will gradually replace the others. And so by a series of steps like this, you will get chemical systems of increasing sophistication and you'll wind up with the first living cell. So that's the chemical evolution idea. So of course, the underlying principle here are the laws of chemistry and physics. Now, phylogenetic evolution is the discussion of everything from the first cell on up to all the different life forms in the world today. This is actually what Darwin mainly concentrated on. His idea is that if you started with one very primitive organism, perhaps something like an amoeba, then in due course of time, by purely physical processes, you'd wind up with all forms of life. This diagram shows one reconstruction of historically how this process is supposed to go. This is a phylogenetic tree. Much of the discussion of this kind of process is carried out in the context of paleontology and the fossil record. This particular chart shows the origin of the plants, land plants, which supposedly radiated from a very kind of primitive vascular plant in the Devonian era, and in due course of time gave rise to all the different forms of plants that we have today. So much discussion about defects in the theory of evolution focuses on this fossil record and the interpretation of the fossils. I'm not going to concentrate on that in this talk, but I will make a couple of points just to set the scene. Namely, that there's a great deal of room for various interpretations, and there are many, many controversial points. So, for example, in this diagram, you'll see many dotted lines which represent supposed links between different orders of plants and so on, links of evolutionary descent. But there's no real evidence for it. They're quite conjectural. And in fact, in this particular example, this is taken by a paper from a prominent botanist. Here we have another model of the same evolutionary sequence which he proposes. In this one, instead of having one everything radiating from one source, as you see here, on the basis of various evidence, he has various groups having an independent ancestry from what he calls ?independent algal sources in the Precambrian. So there's a great deal of controversy and uncertainty. Basically, in the fossil record, you have evidence that various kinds of life forms have existed in the past. But the real question is, well, how did they come about? So what we want to discuss is whether or not they could have come about by physical processes. So the approach I'm going to take is, interestingly enough, summed up by Kurt Gödel. Actually, I encountered this recently. This also indicates that skepticism about the validity of evolutionary theory is not limited simply to uneducated people, as has often been charged. For example, Gödel is one of the most prominent founders of mathematical logic as it's understood today. And in the 30s, he came up with Gödel's theorem, which is quite famous, caused a revolution in that subject. So this is a commentary on his views made by Huo Wang, who's a student of his. And he points out, after making some other remarks, that more generally, Gödel believes that mechanism in biology is a prejudice of our time which will be disproved. In this case, one disproval, in Gödel's opinion, will consist in a mathematical theorem to the effect that the formation within geological times of the human body by the laws of physics or any other laws of a similar nature, starting from a random distribution of elementary particles in the field, is about as unlikely as the separation by chance of the atmosphere into its components. So this is a somewhat hyperbolic way of putting it. But what I would like to discuss here today are some lines of argument which point in the direction of what Gödel is saying. And we'll see, I don't know, I hope there'll be time, that some very interesting philosophical themes will very naturally arise in this discussion. So the first thing to discuss then is what we mean by natural processes, what we mean by the laws of physics. So here is a simple illustration of two physical laws to give an idea. On the top we have a diagram illustrating Coulomb's law for the attraction or repulsion of two charged particles. The idea is that at X and at Y, you have particles with charge E1 and E2, and they're separated by a distance of R. So the force of attraction or repulsion between the two particles is given by this formula we have right here. It's called the inverse square law. And the main point to make about it is that it's actually quite a simple formula. Simple in that it's can be very succinctly written down in a symbolic form. Also, it's quite easy to conceptually understand if you imagine that somehow the attraction is being spread out over the area of a sphere, which goes as 4 pi r squared, so that the point y, its attraction to x, will diminish with the square of the distance. So that's one example of a physical law. Here we have another example. This is Hooke's law for elasticity. Here you have a spring which is being stretched, and the amount of stretch is given by Q. And the pull by which the spring wants to pull back varies with the square of the stretch. So once again, you have a very simple relationship. Well, if you look at the various principles in physics, you will find that actually they are all based on a very few simple laws of this kind. So physics has had quite a history. At the present time, the predominant theory in physics is quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics in particular is believed to give a full account of all chemical reactions. And the standard view in biology today is that living organisms are simply systems of chemicals interacting according to chemical reactions. So it follows then that the laws of quantum mechanics are sufficient to account then for all activities of living organisms. That's the current view in biology. So the idea of the theory of evolution then ultimately boils down to the idea that quantum mechanics should fully account for all the processes which give rise to life as we know it. So I wrote down an example, the laws of quantum mechanics that would be sufficient to describe a model of evolution. So this may look pretty complicated, but actually there's really not very much here. There are, let's see, 6 terms in this equation. This equation on the top is the Schrodinger equation, which is the basic equation in quantum physics for describing how matter transforms with the passage of time. And one term in that, which is called the Hamiltonian, the symbol H, is given in greater detail in Part B. And it consists of a few terms which describe different kinds of interactions of particles. For example, this first term describes free electromagnetic radiation. And the next term describes kinetic energy, momentum of particles, such as electrons and protons. The next term describes how particles interact with electromagnetic fields. Actually, then the next term describes something called spin, which comes up in quantum physics. And the final term is that Coulomb's law, inverse square, principle for attraction and repulsion. So, essentially, these formulas by themselves will suffice to describe how matter transforms in accordance with modern physics. So, however, to say what is happening in a physical model, it's not enough just to have the equations describing the transformation of that model. You also have to have some things called initial conditions and boundary conditions. So here's a little diagram to explain what's involved there. This area here that's crosshatched, that represents a given volume of space. And as time passes, this diagram represents what's happening within that volume. So, of course, the volume is represented two-dimensionally. So its boundary is this curve that goes around it. Of course, in a real volume of space, you have a surface going around it. So in order to predict physically what happens within this volume as time passes, you need to know two things. One, you need to know the conditions that prevail at time zero, that is, when you start your consideration. So you need to know how you start out here in the beginning. Those are called initial conditions. And then, as time passes, you need to know what's happening on the boundary of the system. So if you know those two things and the physical laws, then, in principle, you can calculate what the final state of the system is going to be. So what we want to do is consider a model like this in which one could talk about evolution and the origin of life. So, ideally, we'd like to talk about the most universal kind of model possible, namely the universe as a whole. It's instructive to consider the models of the universe that people are making nowadays. The most popular model at the present time is called the Big Bang Theory. And according to the Big Bang Theory, if you go back, well, the time varies, but maybe something like on the order of 16 billion years, you'll find that all the matter in the universe is compressed into one highly condensed plasma of extreme temperature. So the idea is that the universe begins with a very compressed mass of gas or particles, fundamental particles, at a very high temperature. The idea is then that it expands, and as the expansion takes place, the gas cools off, galaxies and stars condense out, and then around some of the stars, planets will form the gravitational contraction of the gas. And then on some of these planets, oceans will form, and then in the oceans, due to chemical reactions and the bombardment of light from the central star, various processes of self-organization of matter will occur, and you'll get a living cell. And then everything evolves from that. So that is the general picture which is being considered at the present time. The key thing to note about this is that the initial conditions are extremely simple, because the initial state of the system is just a hot gas at uniform temperature. There's no diversity there. In fact, a uniform gas can be described by very simple thermodynamic equations, quite as simple as the other equations that I wrote down. So, and of course, in a Big Bang Theory, there's no boundary, so there are no boundary conditions. So one might consider making a model of this for study. Unfortunately, you can't quite do that at the present time. There are problems with the Big Bang Theory. namely the theory hasn't been formulated yet as an actual physical theory. I won't go into the reason for that in detail. Basically, to make a Big Bang theory, you have to combine two things, Einstein's general theory of relativity and quantum mechanics together. The general theory of relativity will describe how things expand, and the quantum mechanics will describe how the particles behave, so you need both of them. But thus far, nobody knows how to put them together. So we can't quite do that at the present time. But we can consider a model of a primordial planet being bathed in solar radiation. We can formulate that. So just to see how it would work out, I tried to do that. Once again, our initial conditions are quite simple. We start out with a cloud of gas, and we set up the initial motions within the cloud of gas so that this cloud naturally will contract gravitationally. And the idea is that it should form a planet. Of course, actually, there are many dynamical problems involved in actually proving that such a cloud would form a planet. That's another very much open question. But at least in principle, this is the idea of how it's supposed to happen. So we form a planet, and here we have some boundary conditions. We have electromagnetic radiation coming in. We just postulate that as a source of light. And that electromagnetic radiation will bathe the surface of this planet. So ideally, as the planet collapses, it should differentiate, oceans should form, and so on. And the electromagnetic radiation is coming in. And one might expect to see these processes of evolution take place. So for the purpose of this analysis, the thing that we want to do is ask how complex our model is. The basic theme is that actually the model is quite simple. I've already mentioned the laws of physics that you need to describe what happens in the model. This is a rough description of the initial conditions. So we can measure the complexity essentially by the number of symbols it takes to describe this entire model in all its details. To do that formally, we have to have an alphabet and a specific language in which we write these symbols. And one uses a computer language for this purpose. So this brings us to the subject of what's called information theory. So I'm going to make some observations of a mathematical nature, but I'll try and make it quite qualitative so as to explain the concepts. I think that one can make a number of clear points that way. So the basic idea is to describe this model symbolically. You can do it, as it turns out, in less than about 100,000 bits. Bits means ones and zeros. Essentially, in this information theory field, we break everything down to ones and zeros and write it out in strings of these. So, by coding the different symbols and formulae and so on in this model, you can write down a complete description of it in about 100,000 bits. So that gives an idea of the complexity of such a model. So that's the first step of the physical setting in which the processes are supposed to occur. Now the next thing to consider is the question of what it is that we want to study. That is, what is going to evolve within this system. So there we're talking about living organisms. And so the theme that we'll pursue is to inquire into the information content or the complexity of living organisms and see if an estimate can be made. So here's some data. This is taken from Watson's Molecular Biology of the Gene. This is on the can give a certain idea of the complexity of life forms. The first thing we start to talk about are proteins, which are found within living cells. Proteins are long chains made up of 20 different types of amino acids, which fold in a very complex way. And they perform very remarkable functions within cells. A typical protein in a living organism may have, say, on the average of 300 amino acid subunits in the chain. It varies quite a bit, but that's an average figure. So to describe such a protein, that is to write a description of it in symbols, essentially you'd have to specify 300 different, say, numbers from 1 to 20, identifying those amino acids. So you can express that in bits also, which is the standard measure for information that we use. And a typical protein, just to write down in the simplest form a description of it, would take about 1,300 bits. So that gives an idea of what it takes to describe one protein. So in a bacterial cell, there could be, say, 2,000 to 3,000 proteins. The particular cell that we're using here is Escherichia coli, which is studied quite a bit in biochemistry. So 2,000 to 3,000 proteins, and with this many bits per protein, you get about 2.5 to 4 million bits to describe all those protein molecules. Apart from proteins, in the cell, there's the DNA, which is believed to carry the hereditary information for the cell. And from this, we can also get a certain idea of the complexity of the cell. For example, in the E. coli, the amount of information needed to describe the genetic coding of its DNA comes to about 5.5 million bits. And to get an idea as to how big that is, if you wrote this out in pages on a book of an ordinary size, using a 64-character alphabet, then it would take about 330 pages to write down that much material. So that gives an idea of the amount of raw information, so to speak, that it takes to describe these very large molecules within a E. coli bacterium. Now we can go to a mammalian cell, just to go to a more complex organism. Watson estimates that a mammalian cell will have maybe 20 to 50 times as many structural proteins. So that comes to about 84,000 to 210,000 separate proteins of, on the average, 300 amino acids apiece. And also, it's estimated that the amount of DNA in a typical mammalian cell is about 800 times as much as, say, an E. coli bacterium. So in pages, as before, that comes out to about 264,000 pages of information to write that down. So this is a very gross idea of the complexities of living cells. It's useful to consider, of course, the actual structures that we're talking about. Here, for example, is a illustration of one protein molecule. They're quite intricate structures, and these protein molecules perform rather remarkable functions within cells. I'll just give one example of some of these functions. There's a protein called DNA gyrase. You then take another strand of DNA that's nearby, pass it through the break, and join the other two DNA strands up again, so that now that strand's been brought over to the other side. So it's a molecule that can do all of this. So you can sort of appreciate that it'd take quite a complicated machine to do that. At least it's it would take something. So there are many different remarkable enzymes like that, and more are being discovered all the time. So the point here is to get an idea of how much it takes to describe all of these things. So another example, this is a diagram of one of the transfer RNA molecules. You may have seen descriptions of how from DNA you go to messenger RNA, and then that is transcribed to form proteins. There's a genetic code in which the RNA has three-letter code units in a sequence along the strand of the molecule, And there's a process that translates those code units into amino acids and builds these protein chains. So this transfer RNA is one of the molecules that links a particular amino acid with a particular code symbol. It's called an anticodon. So actually this in itself brings up an interesting question about origins of life, which I'll just mention briefly. These processes whereby the protein is transcribed in the DNA molecule themselves require large numbers of highly specific and complex enzymes, which are themselves produced by that very process of transcription, in which are encoded in the DNA. For example, for this transfer RNA thing to perform its function, it is necessary for the appropriate amino acid to be connected onto the molecule. The amino acid has to be one that's appropriate for the particular anticodon, which is at the other end of the molecule. If the wrong amino acid is placed there, then a mistake will be made in transcribing the protein. So there are enzymes called synthetases, which can recognize the shape of a particular transfer RNA molecule and can also recognize the right amino acid to go with it and then fit the two together. So without these proteins, how could the system work? And yet the proteins are produced by the system, so you have a vicious circle. And it represents quite an enigma, although various efforts have been made to try to provide an answer to this. But the main point that I want to make here is that these things are quite complex. I have a couple of other examples. Here, for example, is a organelle which is found in that same E. coli bacterium. It turns out that this bacterium has a molecular motor built into its cell wall which rotates a spiral flagellum, and that acts like a screw on a propeller to drive the bacterium through the water. It's a rather fascinating story how they figured all these things out. This diagram represents a reconstruction of the motor. It looks rather similar in some ways to an electric motor. There's some kind of armature, and then an axle, and this section here is a universal joint that is flexible, and that connects to the spiral flagellum. So apparently the bacterium can run this motor in forward or reverse, and by doing this in the appropriate way, it can swim from environments that are unfavorable to ones that are favorable. Specifically, it can detect the presence of different kinds of chemicals. And if there's a chemical that the bacterium likes, it will swim in such a way that it goes towards higher concentrations of that chemical. So not only is there the motor, but there's a sensory system which is coordinated with the functioning of that motor. So it's interesting to consider how something like this would arise. As for the amount of information needed to describe it, they've studied this to some extent, and they think that for this motor itself, some 22 different genes within the bacteria are necessary. And you can see that quite a few considerations would go into a description of such a thing. For example, it's not just enough to set up the motor so that it functions. You also have to describe how it's constructed within the cell, and so many other things. So this is an example of a very simple organelle within a bacterium. If you go to higher forms of life, you find no end of highly complex structures. Here's something that I just took from random from recent Scientific American. It turns out that some species of butterflies have a sort of metallic iridescent appearance. And the reason for that turns out to be interesting. On the surface of the wing, they have little diffraction gratings which are supported on stilts. So these diffraction gratings diffract the light into a rainbow pattern. So you might consider, well, what does it take to give a description of that structure, an engineering specification? And you can go to other complex things. Here's an eye. If you look at a single organ such as the eye of a human being, you find a rather incredible amount of information which is needed. I was talking with one anatomy student who was describing to me, I think it's called Descemet's membrane, which is one little membrane on the inner side of the cornea. And he said whole theses have been written about it for graduate school in medicine. So practically anywhere you look within a structure like this, you find incredible complexity. For example, in the retina, there are many different cells, and so on. In fact, if I started describing it, it would take a very long time to finish. So the basic point is that a great deal of information is needed to describe living organisms. So what we'd like to do is get a minimum estimate. The previous numbers that I gave a very gross estimate of what you're dealing with. So we need a minimum estimate. So here's some idea of how you can get that. This is a little bit mathematically involved, but I'll try and describe some of the concepts which are involved with it. So the basic question is, how do you add information? Suppose A and B represent two batches of information, and you want to know how much information you have together. Well, it turns out that the additive process is something that you can sort of describe by a diagram like this. The two sets of information may have something in common. That's represented by this overlapping area. So when you want to add them together to get the total amount of information, you essentially, when you add B onto A, what you really want to consider is the information in B that's not already given to you by A. So that's the principle that you want to take into account when combining pieces of information together. So in order to obtain an estimate, what we'll do is break down a living organism into many parts, different organs, organelles, and so on, and then consider combining them together to consider what the total amount of information is. Actually, I have a diagram here showing what we're considering. This strip represents a long sequence of symbols and some kind of code, which code for the different kinds of structures that go into a living body. And as I've indicated, there are many different highly complex structures that you want to deal with. So in order to describe the amount of information, we take this strip, code strip, and break it into pieces representing the various individual organs. So here, these pieces are labeled Y1, Y2, Y3. It goes out to Yn. For example, Y1, Y2, and Y3 were individual proteins, and by the time you got out to capital N here, you have in the order of 100,000 of them. So essentially, you can go step by step. Xn means all of the Ys up to Yn, the whole group of them. So then Xn plus 1 means you add on to that group the next Y, namely Yn plus 1. So the information in Xn is essentially equal to the information in Xn minus 1 plus the additional information needed for Yn. So what's involved in estimating that? You can consider that if, say, Yn is identical with one of the Ys that came before, then you don't need any additional information to describe it. So that's something called redundancy. But one can make an estimate that, on the average, a certain amount of additional information is to be expected to describe the successive structures, be they proteins or organs or whatever. So one estimate that I made is, say, if you take the genetic coding for a mammalian cell, which is estimated to be about 260,000 pages. So suppose you assume that on the average you need no more than 6 bits of information additional per page in order to specify that sequence. So that's a very low estimate. But still, even if you make an assumption like that, it comes out that you have at least 6,000 bits of information that you're describing. 600,000. So the basic idea here is that in the structures you find in living organisms, a great deal of information will be needed. So thus far we haven't said anything about evolution, but at this point we can begin to do so, because it turns out that you can then apply a mathematical theorem. So this formula is what we want to talk about. I'll explain what the formula essentially means. We want to ask, given that we start our system with the particular initial conditions that we were talking about, and we let a certain amount of time elapse, say a few billion years or something like that, we want to know the probability that a given structure will appear within the system. So we can get an estimate of that. Here, this P of X sub n is that probability. It's the probability that X sub n will appear within the system. So this this little c here, it's not too important. It's an artifact of the mathematics. It's a small constant of about 300 bits. The next thing we come to is the log of t. T is the maximum number of configurations you can pack into your system. That's also a technical thing that you need. Sort of the volume of the system. We can say that it's less than, say, 10 to the 80th power. This is based on a common estimate that there are 10 to the 80th power particles in the universe, which I don't take too seriously, but at least it's given frequently that there are that many particles in the universe. So you couldn't have more configurations all at once than that, because if you allowed only one particle per configuration and there are that many in the universe, that's the maximum. So T is less than that. The next thing, L of M, this is the amount of information needed to describe the model, which we talked about before. That came out to about 100,000 bits. And the final term, this L of X sub n, is the amount of information needed to describe that particular configuration that we're asking about. We're asking if a certain configuration will arise within the system. So if we substitute in the different numbers we have P of X sub n is less than, well, this constant, the log of T comes out to 266, as it turns out. And you have the 1,000 bits for the model. You subtract the 600,000 bits for the structure that we're interested in. But that very much dominates the whole sum. You have a very big negative number, 2 to a very large negative power. And in powers of 10, it comes out to be less than 10 to the minus 150,000th power. So that gives the probability that a structure of this information content will arise within the physical system. So this is a very small probability. In fact, it's extremely small. You can get an idea of how small it is by saying, since we're dealing here with a model of one planet, suppose you had a lot of planets and you asked, well, what is the probability that on at least one of them this particular structure would arise? So say you had 10 to the 1,000th power planets. That's a lot. You consider 10 to the 1,000th power, one followed by 1,000 zeros. So the probability that on at least one of them this structure would arise would be 10 to the 1,000th power times 10 to the minus 150,000th power, but that's 10 to the minus 149,000th power. In other words, it hardly makes a dent in this figure. So it's an exceedingly small probability, essentially vanishingly small. So I'll illustrate this formula graphically and make a little diagram that illustrates what's going on. Essentially what the formula does, in this diagram, the x-axis here, going to the right, measures information content. And we imagine that at each point on this axis, we have distributed perpendicular to that points representing all the different forms of that information content. So say right here, the forms that go this way would be those of that particular information content. So these would be complex forms. And back here, you'd be dealing with simple forms. So that's what we're trying to represent in this picture. Actually, the number of forms of a given information content goes up exponentially with the information content. So actually, you can imagine the forms are very much denser out here than they are in here. So the vertical axis represents the probability that in our physical model, the form can arise, a particular form can arise. So in this diagram, we consider two possibilities. One is that you have this peak representing very complex forms. Actually, the way the peak is spread out indicates we're considering a variety of possible highly complex forms. And this other peak at A represents a collection of simple forms. So this curved surface is the cutoff on probability, which is given by that inequality. Essentially, what it does is it says that you cannot have the appearance of complex of forms of a complexity above a certain level. And in fact, the level is given to you by this constant, L of M plus log T plus C. So essentially what the information theory says is that there's a constant of nature which provides a limitation on what can evolve within the physical system. Anything more complex than that will not evolve because the probability will be exceedingly low. Something of lesser complexity could arise. So that's an interpretation of what this formula means. I'll try and explain a couple of other points about it also. For example, it's important to emphasize here that we're not talking about sheer chance. Of course, anyone will admit that if you say, try to write down a large number of symbols purely by chance, like the monkeys on the typewriter typing Shakespeare's plays, then the probability that you'll get a particular sequence is exceedingly remote. But we're not exactly dealing with chance here. We're also dealing with the action of natural laws. So when certain laws are acting, the probability of something arising can be made larger. This is a simple example. We have this word configuration. So suppose we tried to spell that word by choosing letters from the alphabet at random, 13 letters, and just wrote them down. What would be the chance that we'd get the word? Well, there are 26 letters, so the probability would be 26 to the minus 13th power, which is a small value. But suppose we then introduced some law that modified how we chose these letters. The example I selected here was, suppose we say the ratio of vowels to consonants is 6/13, because that's what it is in configuration. So we apply a rule. Well, then the probability comes out to be this number. And as you can see, it has 5 to the minus 6 in it and 21 to the minus 7. It's a much bigger number than this other probability. So by imposing the appropriate rule, we can increase the probability that the given event is going to occur, but it's still a very small figure. So there's a basic way to understand what we're talking about here. That is that the laws of the system can be thought of as instructions which guide the formation of structures within that system. So if you have, say, n bits of instructions, and n bits needed to describe the structure that you're looking for, then if n is bigger than m, you can get the structure, assuming that you have the right instructions written down. But if it's smaller, then there's some missing instructions, and they can only be made up by chance, because that's all the only thing. Once you've exhausted the laws in the system, the only thing that you have there is what is called chance. So what it amounts to is that for each additional bit of information that you need, it goes above the amount of information built into the model, the chance goes down by 1/2. The reason it's 1/2 is that a bit can be one of two things, one of two alternatives. So the chance that you'll be able to get one bit right, which choose at random is one half. So, if you have a structure in which the number of bits needed to define it exceeds the amount of information built into the model by, say, 2 bits, then one half by one half is the probability that you'll hit that. You can give an example of this. Imagine a maze in which there are many forking passages, and in which if you take the wrong passageway, you'll go through a trap door into a lake full of alligators or something like that. So there's only one twisting passageway through this maze. So if you're not given any instructions, the chances are that you won't make it, because you'll have so many different decision points that you have to make the right choice. If you're given full instructions, then you can go all the way through, assuming they're the right instructions. Of course, if they're wrong, you won't make it. But suppose you're given instructions for going halfway. Then, halfway through the maze, you'll do all right, but then you depend on luck to make it the rest of the way. So if you've gone through half of the turns, and there are, say, half n of them left, then one half to the half n power is the probability that you make it the rest of the way through. So that's the sort of thing that we're dealing with here. Natural laws can improve the possibility of a given structure's arising, but only if they provide the instructions needed to specify the structure. And anything they leave out has to be made up by chance. So this is the basic calculation that you can make using information theory. There are many considerations that have to be made in order to make this rigorous, and I won't try and go into them in detail. For example, one thing you want to consider is the idea of superfluous information. We've asked about the probability that one particular structure will arise. So let's say that that's a horse. You want to know the probability that a horse will arise within the physical model. So the thing is, though, a complete description of a horse will have much superfluous information, the exact positions of different pairs and so on. So there'll be a lot of superfluous information there. So there are ways in which you can factor out superfluous information, and probably shouldn't go into it, but you get similar conclusions just with more elaborate discussion. So I'd like then at this point to discuss some of the implications of this study. How can you interpret this? What are its implications for theories about the origin of life? So there are a number of possibilities that you can consider. How could you get probabilities that are reasonably high within a physical system? Well, one way would be to have complex boundary conditions, just to enumerate some of the possibilities. That is, if you had information coming in from across the boundary of the system to specify the forms that were going to develop there, and that's one way you could do it. So, actually, it's interesting. Francis Crick recently came out with a rather curious book in which he proposed such a thing. Actually, it's a rather old idea. But he proposed that the origin of the first cells could be accounted for by saying that extraterrestrial beings in spaceships sent a spaceship containing bacteria to the primordial Earth. So that spaceship landed. So that's an example of information coming across the boundary. Quite remarkable that Francis Crick came up with that theory. It illustrates the problem with that kind of an explanation, though, because as soon as you postulate that some complex information comes in across the boundary, then you have to ask, well, where did that come from? For example, the problem with Francis Crick's theory is that he has to account for the origin of those intelligent extraterrestrials who supposedly made the spaceship. And even in the older panspermia hypothesis, which is a couple hundred years old, in which it was merely proposed that spores would travel in outer space, and maybe they would seed the primordial Earth, and life would begin. Even there, you then have to ask, well, where did the spores come from? And you merely put off the question to a more remote epoch. Of course, here, in the analysis that we're presenting, it wouldn't be sufficient simply to send simple bacterial spores. You'd have to send in information for all the different kinds of complex structures which are later to arise. If you just send information for bacterial spores, you could get bacteria, but you wouldn't get horses, human beings, or whatever. So another possibility in explaining this is to suppose that you have complex initial conditions. So this has similar problems. The idea is that you can say at time zero, at the beginning of your model, a lot of information was built into the system which would then enable it to give rise to different kinds of forms. This question has arisen with respect to the Big Bang theory, for example. Some people once proposed what they called the stacked deck theory. Namely, that in the initial state of matter in the Big Bang, the configurations of atomic motion were just such that later the different things you find in the universe would arise. Actually, they were merely thinking of explaining the origin of stars and galaxies, which in itself is hard for that theory. They weren't considering explaining the origin of life. But the idea was considered with quite a bit of disfavor among the scientists involved. And again, one of the reasons for this is that if you assume these highly complex initial conditions, well, how did they get that way? So, and that somehow seems unsatisfying. So another possibility is to say that the laws of nature really aren't so simple. This, of course, would go against current theories of physics, in which they are simple. But one possibility is to have complex laws. And then another possibility is to say that the life forms come about purely by chance. That's another alternative. This one was introduced by Jacques Monod, interestingly enough. He made this point. He says, the thesis I shall present is that the biosphere does not contain a predictable class of objects or of events, but constitutes a particular occurrence, compatible indeed with first principles, but not deducible from these principles, and therefore essentially unpredictable. So this was proposed by Jacques Monod. Essentially what he's saying is that there's nothing in the laws of nature which would tell you anything about the origin of various life forms, such as human beings. So therefore, it's completely by chance. In other words, what he's saying is that maybe it has a probability of 10 to the minus 150,000th power, but that happened just by chance. So that's another alternative. So at this point, of course, this is a very much a qualitative overview of the whole subject. But I'd like to discuss some of the implications of these things. Essentially, what we have here is a very fundamental paradox which presents an obstacle to explaining things empirically. And that's the paradox of unity and diversity. So, modern science is based on the idea of explaining things in mechanistic terms, that is, in terms of formulas, equations, and so on. The idea of an explanation is a simplification. For example, if you have to describe something in a very elaborate, complicated way, if someone else can come along and describe it very briefly, you say he's explained something. For example, take the trajectory of an object thrown through the air. If you have to list all the points that it follows, which would mean you have to list quite a bit of information, and somebody comes along and says, well, it follows the formula for a parabola, then this is considered to be an advance in understanding what was happening. It's an explanation. So, but the idea that forms, such as the forms of living entities, may have a high information content means that this method of explanation is eventually going to meet with frustration. Because essentially there's no simplifying explanation. So, more than just a critique of evolution, we have here a critique of the power of the mechanistic approach to explain things. Essentially, truly complex forms cannot be explained. They simply are what they are. Because an explanation would mean finding a shorter way of describing the form. And this is also brought out if you consider this idea of chance that Jacques Monod brings in. Actually, it's interesting, a number of other evolutionists have also brought in this concept. What do you mean by chance? It's a very complicated topic to discuss. I can go into the history of it a bit. But essentially, one ultimately evokes chance at the point where he says that something just happens. So, without any particular cause. So, evoking chance to explain an event is essentially like saying, well, that event just is what it is. So we're dealing with very complex structures which cannot be reduced down and described in a simpler form. And essentially what that leaves us with on mechanistic terms is to say, well, it just is what it is. And if you like, you can call that chance. You say, well, it's chance. But essentially it means that there it is. There's no explanation. So this is the problem that arises in a mechanistic attempt to describe the origin and development of life forms. So what I'd like to end with here is to suggest, make a few remarks on mechanistic science. In order to explain complex form, if you're going to do it at all, it's necessary to go beyond mechanism. That is, you've reached the limits of what mechanistic science can do. And it's here that we encounter some problems. Of course, the present tradition in science is strictly mechanistic. And there's a tendency among some people to think that, well, this is the all and all, and that there can't be anything beyond it. So, for example, the evolutionists are saying that evolution is a fact. They're thinking, when they say that some mechanistic explanation is possible, even though we may not have the details of it worked out yet. But, in fact, there are going to be serious problems with finding a mechanistic explanation. So, a problem arises if one then dogmatically asserts that, well, the explanation must be mechanistic. So that is essentially the reason for concern about such statements. I'll indicate very briefly that there are different non-mechanistic approaches to understanding the origin and nature of life. For example, what extent I should go into it. In fact, perhaps instead of doing that, because I see that it's quite a subject of discussion, I'll open this up for questions, and maybe we'll naturally get into such discussions also. Maybe that would be a good idea at this point. So, questions or comments that anyone would like to raise?
Yeah, I got there a little bit late, so I may have missed something. But I'm curious as to a particular, if you will, a mathematical situation. You talk about sets and their complements. Okay. In my understanding of mathematics, that unless two items are complementary, that is part of the whole, the disproof of one in no way is supportive evidence of the other. In other words, if they're just simply elements of a set, if you are not, if they are not complementary, you can show one thing not to be true. You in no way have shown the alternative to be true unless they are complementary in that fashion. So what I'm wondering is what theory you are proposing, as opposed to, since you have not demonstrated, as far as I can see, that showing evolution not to be true is in point of fact supportive of some other theory. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking what evidence you're presenting in support of what theory, or are you merely here today to suggest that there are some weaknesses, which I think any scientist is willing to admit with any theory that is presently presented. I think any good scientist is certainly not going to claim that theories which are designed to explain the natural world are in any way watertight and explain everything completely. Only in mathematics do we have a situation where where we can completely define in that sense.
Yeah, well, you're raising a good point, so I'll try and go through your points in order. First of all, it is quite true that if you you disprove one thing, you haven't necessarily proven some other independent thing. So I'll tell you what my basic idea here is. Various non-mechanistic approaches to explaining the origin of life have to stand on their own. It is not that within a mechanistic framework one can prove anything about something non-mechanistic. The mistake would be to say that within a mechanistic framework, we can't prove anything about something non-mechanistic. Therefore, it is somehow intellectually less viable to talk about such things. That's one point, because sometimes it does happen, although, of course, as you say, a scientist who is at all reasonable will have to admit that there are so many deficiencies, either actual or potential, in our present theories. Nonetheless, scientists very often do present a very dogmatic view of things. And I would advocate the approach to science that you're describing as opposed to the dogmatic approach. Now, as for what this analysis points out, I think this does contribute something to an understanding of physical theories. Because, of course, no doubt one can argue at different points in this analysis also. It's not going to be perfect, just as you say. But the analysis at least suggests very strongly that within our standard concepts of physical theories, which have been very prominent in science, there's a fundamental limitation to what could evolve, which I think is worth noticing. Like I mentioned, you get a constant of nature in this study. Based on the physical laws, you can calculate this constant, which I did for the quantum model, is about 100,000 bits. And it says that nothing more complex than that is likely to appear. Anything beyond that is essentially going to be a product of pure chance, which I think is worth considering as a fundamental limitation on the mechanistic viewpoint. So I wanted to offer that for people's consideration. And also bring up this point that science sometimes is dogmatic. Of course, one can try and analyze the reasons for that. Sometimes it seems that maybe it's a matter of insecurity. In the history of science, it's frequently happened that once a given theory is quite solidly established, that universal claims will be made for it. This happened, there's a story about Max Planck, who was advised, he was wondering whether to go into physics or be a pianist. And he was advised to be a pianist because the subject of physics was closed. Because in that day, there was great confidence prevailing that we've really got physics figured out. But then, of course, everything changed during the next 30 or 40 years. So, likewise, an open-mindedness is needed. And as I've said, we talk about the mechanistic approach in modern science. A non-mechanistic approach to things will necessarily be quite different from what we do in science as it stands today. For example, it may involve meditation. It may involve achieving higher states of consciousness by different internal processes and so on and so forth. So one should
consider the possibility that these may be viable ways of finding out about things which one cannot find out about by mechanistic or empirical science as we know it. And I'm suggesting here that this question of the origin of life is one question where mechanistic science may reach a real impasse. So I just wanted to offer that.
I think we're going back to our question of complementarity in a sense. Again, you seem to be implying that that somehow the approach that you're suggesting is precluded by science. In other words, science, just as science chooses, if you will, a mechanistic approach, perfectly legitimate to do what you suggested, but to expect that to be accepted within a mechanistic framework, I think is unreasonable. In other words, no one is saying that someone cannot meditate to try and determine the origin of life, but
well,
that
should
take this non-mechanistic approach and expect it to be accepted within a mechanistic framework seems unreasonable.
Oh, I'm not saying that. As I pointed out, within the mechanistic framework, as long as you're playing that game within that framework, you can't even talk about anything non-mechanistic. As for example, the positivist will point out to us.
And as you carefully stated, which is absolutely true, that within today's context, and I'm going to include quantum mechanics in your mechanistic approach, that it is not deterministic, but it is mechanistic, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
That by definition, science as we know it, as the present day, and as it has been for many hundreds of years, and depending on whether you want to interpret the Greek philosophers and the Egyptians, Babylonians, and all of the important history, there are mechanistic aspects that you could say science goes back in a mechanistic, how should we say, vein all the way back to as far as recorded history goes, and then presumably even back further than recorded history. And the question that arises is, this is a tradition within which one can discuss certain kinds of things. Certainly the tradition of meditation and speculation and thought and all the other traditions which are not mechanistic also go back that far or even further. But does anyone suggest that these are incompatible in the sense of saying both cannot exist in the same human being or both cannot exist in the same world?
Well, both can exist, and both can go on. Merely one should recognize the limitations of each. And what I'm doing here, what I propose that this contributes, is an idea of limitations of the mechanistic viewpoint for describing the origin of complex form. Admittedly, you may say that is negative. That is as much as you can get from the mechanistic analysis per se. It, I think for some at least, points in a non-mechanistic direction for seeking explanations, but you don't have to do that. What I would suggest is that the upshot of this analysis for science is that, of course, as we know, you can explain and deal with many things in mechanistic science as we have it, but you probably won't be able to explain the origin of life and the development of different kinds of living beings.
Would you admit if scientists at some time in the future were actually able to create a living cell through experimentation of some sort or another? One can always argue that some external force intervened, but assuming that scientists, through their theories, their mechanistic theories, were actually able to create such a living cell, would you at that point be willing to accept that a mechanistic theory was a viable alternative to working out the questions of the origin of life?
Well, if you consider, actually there you're raising a different issue. The issue of whether or not a living organism is entirely a biochemical mechanism. This entire discussion has strictly dealt with the biochemical aspects of living organisms. We haven't even brought in the question of whether or not there is something more in a living organism. Of course, as you expect, I have a view that there is.
Let's leave it there.
I'm
interested in getting your response just to this point.
So, the point he raises, if scientists were able to construct a living cell, would
plausibly, like what could be
No, they don't even have to do it. If they construct it through a basic set of mechanistic physical laws, in other words, if they achieve that, just as we transplant a heart or something like that, and we can explain how we did it and so on and so forth.
It's
in other words, using basic mechanistic science, you know, would that be sufficient to convince you that this was a tractable problem within the realm of mechanistic science?
Not for the origin of that cell. If you look at the analysis that I'm presenting here.
Okay, but you're suggesting, and let me get this clear. Are you suggesting that it might be possible to produce life, but in the specific case of the Earth, it didn't happen that way?
No. Notice the difference between a scientist producing the cell in his laboratory by some chemical manipulations and the question we're considering. There, you're starting with the scientist.
Right.
He's already a very complex being. And in fact, not only that...
All right, you're saying it can't arise by chance, but that's what I'm saying. That's a separate issue from whether it could arise at all by mechanistic means. In other words...
You're asking whether it can exist in mechanistic terms.
What I'm saying is, you're saying this question cannot be dealt with from the standpoint of mechanistic science because, or you're suggesting you look outside of mechanistic science for questions origin of life. And I'm saying, if, in point of fact, we could, through mechanistic science, actually create a living cell, okay, whether or not this actually tells us that this is the way it happened on the Earth, wouldn't this at least indicate that life itself could be created through a mechanistic process and therefore is amenable to mechanistic thought?
In order to answer that question, you should look at the specific reasons that I did give in this presentation. Namely, I'm saying that the reason that a mechanistic explanation for the origin of the cell will not work is that in such a mechanistic explanation, in such a mechanistic model, rather, you have to have the information for the cell built into the system, or else you have to suppose that the arrangement arises purely by chance, or some trade-off between the two, as I described in terms of that formula. So the point that I'm making then is, suppose a scientist were to build a cell. He's got the information.
That is correct. No, that was my point. The question, I understand what Peter's getting at, but I think there's a more interesting way to put it, because it corresponds to real research. Mm-hmm. The sort of thing that Quantum Proof is doing in the lab here, it may well succeed.
Okay.
I mean, they aren't just jockeying around. They are trying to up with plausible models of what conditions are actually like. And so the question is really interesting here, given the things that you said earlier, is what if one of these guys, Sidney Fox or Cyril Pottenberg, or one of these guys, using plausible models of what really could have been going on, that means that he manages to get a self-replicating molecule.
Okay. Let me,
of course, is what the real research is all about.
Let me try and answer your question, because it depends on how he gets it. So, in answer to the first question, let me say this. Suppose you did start with a system with some simple initial conditions, an arrangement of gas and a flask, I don't know what it would be, and you let some things happen in there according to simple processes, and indeed you got a halfway decent cell. Then that would completely defeat everything I was suggesting here.
Okay.
But, on the other hand, what he seemed to be suggesting was, if you could, by engineering techniques, build a cell.
I understand the connection between these problems.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I think I was suggesting the same thing. If there's any difference between, I was not suggesting in any way that we're taking a little, little micro manipulators or something and putting little organisms in this and reconstructing, because that's already been done in the sense that we have already taken cells as such. And remove a nucleus, taken a nucleus from somewhere else or DNA from somewhere else and put it into a cell and created a different kind of thing. That's already been done. Nobody's suggesting manipulating with already existing material. What I was specifically referring to was exactly the same model he's talking about. In other words, creating a living cell through strictly, if you will, I was trying plausible chemical conditions, physical conditions, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But I was trying to avoid the question of asking the question of whether, in fact, these were the real conditions that existed on the Earth,
okay.
But only ask the question that you set up a set of conditions in which this production takes place, regardless of whether these were the original conditions, because we can go back to your original question, which is conventionally called panspermia. Perhaps the Earth was seeded from somewhere in space, but maybe these conditions existed somewhere else or something similar.
Right.
So I'm not arguing. I'm saying if any conditions ever that might exist anywhere could be set up, in other words, any conditions you can set up could do it. In other words, you can do it, take chemicals and various energy sources and put all this stuff together and produce living cells.
Yes, if you could set up a model like that, which, as I say, I'm differentiating from engineering the thing, but a simple model with something happening in it, and a genuine living cell comes out, that would disprove what I'm saying here.
Okay,
be a counter.
That's what I was asking. So you'd be willing to admit, if somebody succeeds in that way, that, that the problem was practical?
If that's what they did do, they'd have proven it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there two versions of the problem that we've dealt with? One, if you're 100,000 things, you can tell the coarse grain phase.
What's that?
The coarse grain phase mix. I mean, we've got this system here, and the question is how much information does it take to describe it? Well, it depends on what level you want to describe it. I mean, one of the points that has come up in these sort of discussions of the whole entropy question is, you take the phase space, you want to talk about how much entropy there is in the system. Well, that doesn't always have a straightforward answer. It depends on just exactly how you want to describe it. Information, the use of the word is rather interesting because it's no accident to suggest something about how these types of things set up our description. So I think that there'd be a lot of writing about that term of question. The other problem that I see is this. I think it's incredibly improbable that there should be a horse. Incredibly improbable that there should be a horse. But that's not the issue. The issue is how probable it is that there should be something at all of that sort, whether a horse or whether something on a personal wind or who knows what.
Okay.
That's a different question. The CGD is incredible.
Okay. So I'll try and answer a few questions. First of all, as for the physical model, there's no problem with that figure, 100,000 bits, because the point is that to describe, it's not that we're talking here about breaking down phase space into units and describing individually what's there. We're dealing with large-scale ensembles. Now, let me make a few points about this. You might raise the objection. I'm saying the initial conditions are very simple, but what about the exact positions of all the molecules? For example. So there are two ways you can go about this. One is, if you deal with a statistical ensemble for different possible arrangements, like Gibbs canonical ensemble and things like that, then the total description of all the possibilities is simple, and that's what actually goes into the equation. Or another route you can take is you can say, suppose you start with something, a more complex description, and you say, okay, well, let's start with that. But then you have to ask, well, which complex description do you take? Now, the point is, if you take, and further examination of the equation shows you this, if you take a complex description with specific information built into it for what you're, the structures that you're talking about getting, then you can get them. But if the information built in is not specific information for the structures that you're talking about, then you won't get them. So essentially what it amounts to is it comes back to that alternative that the information could be built into the initial state of the system. And in this case, we're saying it's built in a complicated form. You're saying that by choosing the states of the atoms in the initial gas in just the right way, you can arrange it so that the ultimate structure comes out. But then one asks, how is it that they happen to be arranged in just that way? And one again comes back to the point that complex structure or form can be transformed, but not ultimately explained, because when you say it's transformed from this earlier state, that's also equally complex, and we haven't explained that. And it actually becomes even harder to explain. I'll give you an artificial example in classical physics that's pretty easy to understand. say you have ball bearings arranged in a square lattice, like at the center of the square is a checkerboard, and it goes out. And it follows a certain path. And let's say the path spells out a word. So you could say, well, isn't it rather improbable that it spelled out that word? Well, at least if we stick to classical physics, you can say, though, that if you specify the initial condition just right, then it could bounce in such a way as to spell out that word. But then the problem is that in that case, the exact direction of the particle in the initial state would have to be chosen, and you'd ask, well, really, why is that direction chosen? In other words, that's as remarkable as saying that the word itself was spelled out.
What about the, excuse me, I think this is one of the most, how do we say, despicable uses of mathematics when you approach something that way. Why shouldn't it be that way? In other words, there's no absolute reason. If you've got to have some initial condition, and you don't specify the goal, or you don't specify if this ball bearing has to be going some direction, if you've got a single case, in other words, if it did it every time, then you can ask yourself, why should it be that way? But if you have one case, why shouldn't it be that way?
Okay.
It could be that way as well as any other way.
So the point I'm making, yeah, why shouldn't it be? But you don't have an explanation. In other words,
you don't need an
excuse
me.
Any trajectory you make is a problem.
Right.
No, that's all well and good. But I'm saying you're not, the point I'm making is that you can't explain the particular form you get. So I'm saying a complex form cannot.
It doesn't need an explanation.
You say it doesn't need it. That's all right. You can say it doesn't need it. But I'm saying you don't have it.
In other words, the fact that a horse exists does not need to be explained as opposed to something else. The fact is the probability that it is greater than zero that a horse could be created by chance is sufficient to allow the fact that
so
a horse exists
to sum up in
to
a
be
very,
allowable.
So as to sum up in a very crude way what I'm saying then is that all we can say about the fact that a horse exists is that it exists.
No, you can say that you can say how it came into existence. You don't have to say that it would come into existence again if the same conditions existed. Since we're dealing with a certain element of probability or a certain element of randomness in this, almost any evolutionist, I suspect, and any physicist, and any chemist, and any biochemist will tell you that the chances of it occurring again in just that way are infinitely small, as the mathematics
well, that gets to his second question.
And so the question is not whether or not such a thing would occur again, but only whether it was possible for it to have occurred once. And the answer is yes, it's possible.
Which we know because it's there.
That's right. And so that's all that's necessary to state is that it did occur.
So if that is satisfactory, the most we can say about a horse being there is that, well, we know that it's possible for it to be there on virtue of the fact that it's there. If that's satisfactory, okay, fine.
Right.
But you won't, so the point I'm saying is you won't be able to say more. But now
that doesn't follow.
I'm saying you won't be able to explain it. Just like we can explain, let me explain, and then I'll get to the second question. You can explain the trajectory followed by a ball moving through the air as parabolic in terms of the law of gravity and acceleration and so forth. So if you're just given the parabola, given that law and so on, can explain it, and at least we think, well, that's an explanation. I learned something about how that ball's moving. So the complex structures of the horse, though, you can't do that.
Sure can. Let's go back to your model that you presented. You specifically stated that in order for this particular ball that was bouncing through to describe a particular word was very low probability.
I didn't say probability.
If it had a particular trajectory, then this thing could occur. So your explanation of it is the ball had this particular trajectory
yes.
at the beginning, and that's how it occurred. In the same way, we can describe how the horse came to be through the system. Now, the question is why the system had the initial conditions. That can't be explained. It just had the those conditions.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying it just had the initial conditions to later produce a horse.
That's right. In other words, there's no, I don't think any evolutionist suggests that wants to go back to first causes in the sense of saying, why were these things there? I think most evolutionists would be perfectly happy to say, you know, if you want to believe that those initial conditions simply existed because of something or some non-thing created those initial conditions back as far as we can take it, then that's not within the realm of mechanistic science to answer that question. But we can go back to the starting point, as it were, as far back as we can push it, say the Big Bang, if you will. And we can say, maybe we don't know, you know, why there is matter in space. It just is.
Okay, so what it amounts to, of course, this isn't what they
but
do.
If we do know that there is matter in space, then matter in space will behave in the following way, according to these laws and so on and so forth. But there's nothing that says there has to be matter in space.
Well, that's all well and good. But what we conclude is it's like what Jacques Monod said, that there's nothing predictable within the biosphere in life, that the living organisms and so on and so forth, of course, satisfy physical laws, but they're in no way predictable. So what that amounts to then is to say that we really can't say anything more to explain why they're there. You know, if you trace it back to some earlier complex state, then you can't say why that is there. At some point, we just have to throw up your hands and say, well, it just is that way. So you have to say that a very complex thing just is that way. Well, if that's okay.
What's wrong with that?
Kind of. See, I mean, I never took the purpose of evolutionary biology to be to explain why there are exactly creatures in the biosphere that there are. I never took that to be the point. I took it to be given that we have the ones that have. You know, how did they come?
But that's
I haven't explained that anyway.
The point is not given to you to predict from the set of initial conditions that you started with. You're going to get horses instead of 15-legged centipedes with extra necks or something like that. That's not the issue. That's the way in which you are presenting the one of the evolution. That's not what you started with. And of course, you cannot predict what's going to happen in the biosphere. The very structure of the explanation that he uses makes it clear that he's one product of that.
Well, some people are curious as to why you get horses.
Relative to certain limited assumptions, you can ask that question, and I think you're right. If you push that back far enough, of course no one's going to give a scientific answer. Of course, if you like some kind of answer.
The basic point then is that you're not going to know why you get horses or human beings or scientists. You're not going to know that. Let me answer your second question.
That's what I don't understand. What is it?
Relative to what?
Like, we can explain the parabola of the trajectory. We can give what many people feel is a satisfying explanation of how it is it's following a parabola.
And
we're not going to have such an explanation of how it is we have human beings or horses and so forth.
We can do exactly the same thing. It's not in as precise a way at the present time because it's a far more complex thing than to describe the most simple object.
Well, that's a question of what you can do in principle. Of course, in principle, we can't do this. Just let me give a little answer to the second question you raised, because we've never gotten back to it.
Right.
Because you raised the point that anyone would agree that a particular horse is exceedingly unlikely and would never appear again and so forth. So what you can do, there's a concept which you can further bring in, the idea of traits of information shared in common among a variety of forms. So in this case, for this example, let's take all normal horses, just for one example. Exclude defective ones. So we can talk about the amount of information they share in common. You can deal with this mathematically. So the point that I'm making is that these estimates of information content I've used here actually are referring or are derived to express the amount of information in common in a large category of structures such as the set of horses.
I know. The last suggestion is that your category is not by.
Very good. Very good. So that's a good point. You can make the category larger. Now, what I'm saying is that if you make the category large enough for it to be probable to get something falling within that category, then you've made it so large that practically it doesn't say much of anything at all. This is the basic argument that I would make. In other words, if your category... Pardon me?
I agree with that.
You agree?
In its sense, but I wouldn't draw a conclusion from it.
Well, so, in any case, just to try and sum up the conclusion we have, just to go back to that bouncing ball example, simple example. If the bouncing ball spells out one of Shakespeare's sonnets, then you can say, well, that's just because the initial condition happened to be just right for it to do that, and that's perfectly satisfying. And if that is satisfying, okay, indeed. But there are some who might wonder, well, why did it spell out that? So I'm saying, essentially, within the framework of mechanistic science, we won't be able to answer such questions. We may not want to.
Yeah.
Some people do.
Okay.
Like, I would be curious as to how we get horses, human beings, and so on.
The person who asks that question doesn't understand science. I mean, because by asking why one of many possible choices that are based on some sort of random event occurs is to ask why I'm sitting in this chair here in this room at this time, which I can give a number of explanations, but basically it all goes back to things that are far too complex to calculate, but it doesn't mean they aren't real. In other words, I could have equally well have been somewhere else at this time as opposed to right here, but I am here because a series of events led to it, but I couldn't go back to my father and mother and say, did you know that your son would be in this position at this time?
All well and good. All well and good.
But it doesn't mean that this event is any less real because of the fact that I can't do that.
So, the basic point we're making, trying to make, is that, yes, of course, you'll say that we can't trace out these particulars, but in a broader form, anything that is predictable that you can trace out, as I tried to say to him, that will be a very broad category. Now, take, for example, something like human intelligence, or intelligence, at least the way we experience it or understand it, or human life with human-type emotions, personality traits, and so on. That's a broad category, including all individual instances of human beings. The question is, can we say anything about that in terms of mechanistic science? I mean, you say, I don't understand science. Well, it's a matter of curiosity. I mean, you can do with science what you can do with it. But still, one is curious about various questions. Can you answer this or not? So the point I'm making is I think you could argue would say, if you took a broad enough category of forms to be reasonably probable, let us say, for intelligent, to describe intelligence or human personality, it would be so broad that it would include many things that are totally alien to what we call human personality. In other words, the fact that you get such a thing as human personality is something that will have to be satisfied that mechanistic science won't tell us. We've got it, it's here, it's possible, it came about somehow, but
I think I understand what you're saying now. Let me try and say what I agree with. And what bothered me about the way that you put it. I think that we don't actually disagree about this, that the kind of question that you're considering here is one which perhaps you've already been successful, but not what the mechanistic science deals with. Fine. Also, a question which one might very well have good reason to be interested in. Fine. And furthermore, to which there might be answers forthcoming from our position of reputation or something like that. No disagreement so far. In fact, maybe we don't disagree about anything, but what bothered me about the way in which you were putting things was this. There was a suggestion at first that somehow there was a question here which mechanistic science, a term I'm not overly fond of, but mechanistic science takes itself to be grappling with, and you've shown that it's going to fail to grapple with, whereas I see it's not a question that mechanistic science takes itself to be grappling with.
Well, it's okay. Perhaps some people don't. I suspect, though, that many people, if they think of, say, the question of explaining such complex forms and such, they would hope that you actually could explain it in the sense we've been discussing. And, of course, in our actual experience, in science, we don't explain such things as facts. The kind of things that are discovered in the scientific realm never give us such explanations. But still, I suspect that many people, including even scientists, have a hope that science is going to explain such things. And as for the theory of evolution, I made some comments that to the effect that there can be a dogmatic idea that, well, this explains everything. And this does arise, which may tend to make you think that, well, no other explanation in this area or no other approach to explanation is going to give the answers. So one needs to have a broad-mindedness.
Yeah, okay, I agree that the scientist takes himself to be answering all of these questions, including. Maybe we don't have to.
Yeah?
Sir, it appears to me as inherently unfair and not pertinent to characterize the theory of evolution as saying that everything arose by chance. Darwin's theory of evolution proposed an adaptive life process in which we find first a source of variability, which is spontaneous mutation, which is known to occur, which is well demonstrated to occur, and the process of selection, natural selection, which culls out unviable forms and which causes a propagation, a selecting out of certain other forms. This is not a random process. It's a selective process. If we were to propose a theory of mutation without natural selection, then these objections would be pertinent. This is not a one-sided theory. It's a two-sided theory. It's a source of variability, natural mutation, which is random. And a source of selection, which is anything but that, and which gives the selecting out process. Why a horse? Well, we have the mutation essentially random, but we have conditions in which the parameters in which there was an environmental niche in which progressively more horse-like things developed and thrive. And less than horse-like things do not thrive so well. Therefore, we have a horse. Given that horses exist, you've altered the environmental conditions such that, in addition to everything else, developing has to exist well in a world which has horses. Grass has to survive being trampled on. Other creatures have to learn to survive well and done, if that's their niche. And so, we don't have a random process yet.
Yeah.
Also, if we want to set up a condition, in the beginning of life, we're again not talking about random processes. We're talking about life arising out of lawful and natural processes, presumably not all of which we at present know. If we want to set up a condition to see whether life will arise spontaneously. And of course, the very existence of these natural laws is indeed a very marvelous thing. But remember, what we have here, to set up a proper experiment, any less than this would demonstrate nothing at all to the negative contrary. And what we want to do is set up an ocean filled with a wonderful organic soup, such as it can be pretty well demonstrated we originally had, and leave it sit there under bombardment of all kinds of vigorous, stirring energies for 2 billion years, and if anything, even once viable, pops up, it will spread like crazy. And then you'll have an environment in which you have spreading little viable...
Okay, could I try and answer some of the points? I have a feeling you're saying we really can predict horses after all. But I understand, I'll try and...
I want to say something further on that. Right now, we have horses. In the past, we didn't have horses. We did something that was before horses. In the future, if horses do not die out, they may tend to modify into something else. In the past 5,000 years,
this is okay.
Man has seen tremendous change in dogs. Right now, we have horses. Horses is what we have. What interests us isn't so much... isn't it amazing that we have horses? I'm inclined to assert that we would have had something. What interests us is to determine the processes by which such things as horses and men and other living things come.
Okay, so let me try and answer the points that you're raising. Because the first point that you made was that essentially I'm only dealing with chance here, whereas of course mutation occurs randomly. That's a chance phenomenon. But the natural selection is a lawful process. It's not random.
Both are lawful processes. One
has a random element.
Just like the clouds themselves change randomly.
So it's okay.
But if you look at the clouds, the looker, are providing a selective process. And you see the patterns which are interesting. Just like pinball moves on, sooner or later it will trace all possible patterns. But the viewer will consider some significant, some not. Well, natural selection considers some configurations by their viability as significant, selects them out and propagates.
Okay, let's talk about natural selection just for a short time. Because, you see, important point to know about natural selection is that it's a derived principle. In other words, natural selection should occur because of the underlying physical laws, as an automatic consequence of those laws. In other words, the idea, I'll give you an example of natural selection. If an organism has a particular trait which enables it to do better in its environment in terms of reproductive success, its population will eventually crowd out all the populations of lesser organisms. That's the idea of natural selection.
Given no other factors.
And, yeah, given all the environmental factors that have to be there at the time and so forth. So the point is, this is occurring due to the underlying physical laws. And as I say, we're taking a mechanistic model of life here. We're talking within that context. So then this must be due to the underlying physical laws. So my question is, will natural selection tend to give us a horse? Now, that's an interesting question. We have examples of natural selection doing something like the peppered moth and so on, which you may know of, which are very simple examples. But will natural selection actually support? That's the question that we want to pose. So what we're doing here is going to a level beneath the level at which one talks about very complicated interactions between horses and trees and grass and hills and so on, which would be very hard for us to deal with. So we're going to the level of the underlying natural laws. So I'm not just considering chance here. I'm considering those underlying natural laws. As I was explaining before, if you have laws that are acting, that can increase the probability of things. The idea of natural selection is that it will increase the probability of things, something that wouldn't occur by chance with any probability at all. The idea is that natural selection, that process, can cause this to come about with a fairly high probability. So to analyze that, we're considering the underlying natural laws. But we're showing that in order to obtain a highly complex form like a horse, the probability is exceedingly remote. In other words, the laws of physics as we know them cannot provide that selection. That's the conclusion of the analysis. One might think, well, maybe they can. But the conclusion of the analysis is that, in fact, those laws can't do it.
What you're talking about in mathematical analysis is very much as if you were setting up the question, what is the chance of organic molecules in a great pursuit spontaneously bringing themselves together into the arrangement of force? Now, that's exceedingly improbable.
That's not what I'm talking about.
However, at this later point, things happen one step at a time. But the question at that later stage becomes, what is the chance that a horse would arise out of the Olympus or whatever it was.
Like I was saying, I'm not talking about the chance that just molecules purely at random make a horse. I'm talking about the whole process, the Olympus in the works. That's what I'm talking about.
And the chance of a horse arising out of the Olympus under conditions where the Olympus had to become larger, faster, and many other things may approach certainty.
Yeah, it may. That's the thing you don't know. So the point that I'm making is that by this analysis you can see that it won't be probable. Whereas if you just talk about what horses might do and what mutations might affect their genes, that's an exceedingly complicated problem. It may, but this indicates no.
Let me give you an example which I think will demonstrate what I mean. In this, we in Europe, in some of our have this thing called a wolf, which is a predatory hairy animal with a certain appearance and so on, and it fills a certain environmental niche, and its whole makeup is adapted to that niche. Now, part of the reason why it's a wolf is because it developed out of something before a wolf, and it had to develop wolfness out of that material. Now, in Australia, and as you know, we natively had marsupials. We didn't have placental mammals. Nevertheless, it's remarkable that Australia produced marsupial wolves, the wolves that look remarkably like our wolves. They're different, certainly the structures, because they were built out of marsupial background, and yet because they were filling an niche very similar to our wolf, they wound up appearing amazingly like our wolf.
So the question is, how did that come about? So this is an analysis
which... Natural selection pressures, I would say.
Yes, very good. That's the theory of evolution by natural selection. The question is, will you really get wolves, and so on. Here is an approach of analyzing it, which suggests a certain answer. As far as speculating about what might have happened with wolves, it's exceedingly fuzzy. One might hope to be able to do that. You know, like the case of the peppered moth, where the color changes. There is an area where you can come up with an explanation. You say, well, the birds are going to eat the moths which stand out on the bark of the trees, and their population ratios will change. There we can actually talk in what I would call a scientific manner. But when you're talking about the wolves, it's all completely vague. So we don't really know whether selective pressures could really do that or not. I know you're thinking maybe selective pressures could do that. That's the theory. The question is, could they really? So here's an analysis which suggests no.